Court will proceed to the fourth case of the day, Velez versus the City of Chicago. Mr. Bry.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel, again, Kevin Bry for plaintiffs' appellants. Your Honor, is very briefly, I would like to remind the court of a distinction in the causes of action here that perhaps the party's briefing doesn't always bear in mind. There are two different causes of action involved here, and the first is the hostile work environment claim. The second is your discrimination case. It's important to keep in mind the differences in these causes of action because numerous of the city's defenses may apply to one claim but have nothing to do with the other. For instance, the city's defenses, such as that Commissioner Altman, the record does not suggest that he had personally a discriminatory animus in choosing to order that the plaintiffs no longer have their exempt status, that's not a defense to the hostile work environment which took place those many months earlier at the hands of Chief Burns. And it's important to keep that in mind. Similarly, the good faith that city personnel such as Chief Altman may have had in acting based on memorandums or investigations that were done, that really has little or nothing to do with the hostile work environment claim. Preliminarily, there are a couple of important matters that affect the scope of this court's review. And I think it's important that the court focus on them because I believe the district court failed to. One is the question of whether any conduct which occurred prior to the date that appellants listed on their EEOC charge may be considered. You'll recall that earliest date was, I believe, in March of 1997. Chief Burns had come on to this unit before then for a few months. Your Honor, I think this record is perfectly clear, or at a minimum, there's a question of material fact here, that there's a continuing violation here. There's a continuing, from the moment Chief Burns got on the scene, there's the brutish and nasty behavior, and some of the discriminatory comments occurred before then. In a hostile work environment case, that's good to be considered, even though it's before the date that was listed under the continuing violation doctrine. And I think that this court should consider that. Secondly, the city objects in this court, although there's no order that I'm aware of in the record showing that the trial court ruled this way, the city objects to this court considering affidavit testimony of the plaintiffs, which allegedly is contrary to their deposition testimony, arguing that some sort of judicial admission was made at the depositions. We cited in our reply brief the pages of the deposition testimony of the plaintiffs where, when asked if there were other incidents they had in mind, they said, "I can't recall. At this point, my memory's not exhausted." The later supplementation or augmentation is not contradictory. It's in line with the types of things that were said. So I don't think that there's any judicial admission against the plaintiffs at that deposition. Indeed, the questioning at the deposition by the city's counsel was prefaced with comments like, you know, just as far as your memory goes today, we're asking you questions, or as best you can recall now. And that's what they did. So this isn't a case where they unambiguously said, no, that's all that occurred. They said, that's the best I can recall. You could look at Velez's deposition early in the testimony. He was taking it on 4 hours of sleep and some medication. And sure, he indicated he could understand and could recall and did give his deposition testimony. But I think that's a matter for a trial if they want to impugn what the plaintiff specifically remembered and didn't remember. It's not as if these are unrelated incidents that were added in the deposition testimony. So I do think it's important to know the scope of the record that's being reviewed because it's de novo review in this court. This court's looking at it freshly. And if you look at the district court's opinion, it simply ignored all these statements, some of these statements, and it just characterized it as is a couple, a handful of comments when there were many, multiple comments expressly talking about race or national origin. In terms of the question, and this is again with respect to the hostile work environment case, as to whether Burns was a supervisor or not, the city says in their briefs that the only real supervisor here is Commissioner Altman. He's the real supervisor, and he didn't know any of these things. The city is picking, they're picking what they want you to look at instead of what plaintiffs are basing their case on. Chief Burns, remember, this is a chain of command paramilitary type of organization, and there's no question he was a supervising officer in this organization. He was in that unit. He had the ability and, in fact, exercised the ability to strip the plaintiffs of their rank within the unit so that all of a sudden they had to answer to lower officers. He had the ability to transfer them to a different office, to take away cell phones and vehicles and things like this.
He took them out of, he had the authority to take them out of the chain of command, did he not?
He did. He had the authority, and he did. He did in March of 1997, according
Many
to the
Any kind
record.
Of a paramilitary organization, seems to me that's important. I mean, that to
I think it is
one's
too.
Career.
Well, I think it's very important.
You've been taken out of a chain of command. You've got a problem.
You've got a real problem, and if that isn't a demotion, I don't know what is in a paramilitary chain of command organization. And the authority to demote or discipline or transfer, that's one of the incidents of supervisory status under Title VII. So, again, at least there's a question of material fact that a jury may feel that Burns was, in fact, a supervisor. And alternatively, if he wasn't, if this court could say as a matter of law he was not, it's clear that the plaintiffs did attempt to go to numerous different individuals, even though they had been forbidden by the superior officer to do that. So I think you do have a question of material fact on the city having notice. If it's all right with the court, I'd like to reserve just the last 2 or 3 minutes for co-counsel. Thank you.
Mr. Norberg?
Thank you, Judge Palm. May it please the court. Appellants do forward two claims in this appeal, and we're well aware of that. There's a hostile work environment claim and an employment discrimination claim. However, the summary judgment record supports neither of these claims. For the purposes of this argument, I'd like to focus on three principal points. First, with regard to the hostile work environment claim, the appellants wholly failed to put the city on notice of their complaints. The person in charge was Commissioner Altman, and they never spoke with him. And although they did speak to Chief Stewart, who was the Equal Opportunity Employment Officer, they failed to tell him that they were complaining about discrimination on the basis of their Puerto Rican heritage. There's no evidence, in fact, that they told anyone that they were being mistreated on the basis of their Puerto Rican heritage. And as a result, there was no notice, and the city cannot be held liable for Chief Burns' behavior. Second point is that in any event, the appellant's work environment was not a hostile work environment. Now, we explain in our brief why the two most troubling of the approximately six individual alleged comments should not be considered by this court in this calculus. But even if we consider all of the comments, appellant's case falls far short of demonstrating a hostile work environment as this court has construed that term in its case law. The Title VII hostile work environment cause of action is reserved for the most repugnant and egregious workplaces. And this case simply does not rise to that level. This simply is not that case. And finally, the third principal point we'd like to stress before you.
Why don't you think it is? I mean, that's a conclusory statement, really, when you get down to it. It doesn't rise to the level. The allegation is they took these people out of the chain of command. It was over a long period of time that they were disparaged on the basis of their nationality or ethnicity. That's a heck of a way to go to work every day.
Well,
against a history here too. You know, I mean, we sit on a lot of cases involving various ethnic groups involved in municipal services in the city of Chicago. This must have stung.
This was over a period of about 18 months. And just putting it in the context of this court's jurisprudence with regard to what it takes to rise to the level of a hostile work environment, it's our position that this does not satisfy that threshold. We do not by any means mean to suggest that what happened here, what allegedly happened here, was appropriate or should have happened. Absolutely not. There's no excuse for bringing national origin into the workplace. It's irrelevant. It shouldn't come up. However, what you're left with here is six, at most, discrete comments having to do with their race in the context, granted, of the removal of certain job duties, et cetera. But the fact is that under the considerations this court has elucidated in its case law, for example, the frequency, which, as I said, it's about six over the course of 18 months, which is just simply not frequent enough in light of what this court has said. There was no physical contact, for example. There was no sort of physical threatening aspect to this. Under the various considerations, this simply does not rise to the level of hostility. Once again, this court has made clear in using terms such as the workplace that is actionable is the workplace that is hellish, that this is a very high standard, and this cause of action is rightfully reserved for very, very repugnant and odious workplaces. And it's our position that the record shows that this did not rise to that level. On that point, it's important to note that even the most odious use of racial epithets has been held in this court in many cases not to be sufficient to create a hostile work environment. For example, in the Smith case, the McFall case, this court has held that the use of racial epithets does not in and of itself necessarily create a hostile work environment.
That's not what allegedly happened here. I mean, there was some activity involved as well, reassignment, things of that nature, being taken out of the chain of command. This wasn't just a rather boorish guy making a couple of cracks.
Granted, but standing alone, the sort of allegations in this case with regard to the removal of certain responsibilities, the removal of certain rights and practices that they had become accustomed to under the earlier regime before Chief Burns came on, would not satisfy Title VII with regard to creating a hostile work environment. That's evident because Title VII, the purpose of it, is to confront and take care of situations where there is intentional discrimination on the basis of a protected group. Obviously, having standing alone, these sort of decisions, I'm going to ask for a second signature, for example, on your work because I'm a little concerned that it's not being done correctly. I'm going to reassign certain assignments and tasks to other people within the office. I'm going to, for example, in the case of Mr. Ortiz, I'm going to require you to undertake some tasks described by them as menial tasks that are actually in your job description and that you could have been made to do to have done all along. Certainly does not offend Title VII. So we would argue that given the small number over the course of 18 months of admittedly inappropriate comments, that this sort of conduct does not create a hostile work environment.
Now, Commander Burns couldn't remove them from their position, is that right?
Exactly. That's a very important point. The fact is that the only moving to actually takes me straight to my third point, Judge Flom, and that is moving to the employment discrimination claim. The only adverse job action that exists in this case was when the appellants were removed from the exempt ranks and returned to their career ranks. And that was done by Commissioner Altman. Commissioner Altman was the only person with the power to do that act, and he was the only person who made the decision. He was the sole decision maker. The exempt ranks in the fire department are a unique set of positions that...
Does the change between exempt ranks and non-exempt ranks involve a difference in remuneration?
It does, exactly. And that also plays into the fact that we concede, and this was clearly an adverse employment act, the removal from the exempt ranks and return to the career ranks. But
does it have any impact on one's career?
I think it certainly does. The return to the career ranks is definitely, although in the technical classic sense of the term demotion, it might not be a demotion because you're essentially being put back into the rank that you've held all along. For example, Mr. Ortiz, throughout this entire throughout his entire tenure with the fire department was always a firefighter. It's just he was serving in an exempt rank for 10 years, and Mr. Velez was always a paramedic, but he was serving in an exempt rank. So they basically had their exempt ranks taken away, and they were put back to where they were before. So it's not a demotion in the classic sense. However, we do concede that that was an adverse employment act for the purposes of Title VII. But the important thing is that that was the only adverse employment act for the purposes of Title VII.
What are the benefits of being in an exempt rank in the fire department?
I think that that would vary, Judge Flaum, from individual to individual. I think it's fair to say that there's a certain amount of prestige that goes with them, in that you get them.
Well, aren't you freed from some of the traditional responsibilities of a firefighter?
Yes, exactly. And if
you've given to what some in the department might say lighter duty?
I think that's probably a fair generalization, and obviously
I mean, I'm not suggesting unimportant, but they're not going into burning buildings.
Precisely. It's comparable to the O'Neill case in this court, where a police officer was returned to the street, essentially, after being working in a desk position for a while. As to whether or not that is a preferable position or not, I guess that would be a matter of taste. Some people would rather be on the street doing a paramedics or firefighter's job. Some people would rather have the desk job that Mr. Ortiz and Mr. Velez had in this case. Nonetheless, the fact remains, and once again, that this was an adverse employment decision. We concede that is not, there's no issue with regard to that. But the salient point is that the only decision maker with regard to this action was Commissioner Altman. And there is no evidence, there's absolutely no evidence, not a single shred of evidence in the record to suggest that Commissioner Altman had any sort of discriminatory animus towards Puerto Ricans or towards any group protected by Title VII, for that matter.
The commissioner may have been the cat's paw, too. Here, you know, I mean, don't we have to consider that possibility?
You can consider that, but in this case, the cat's paw theory does not fit, and here's why. Because the commissioner made the decision based on the reports he received from Nelson and Stelnicki, who they themselves never spoke with Chief Burns, and Altman himself never had any contact with Chief Burns, and therefore there's no way that Chief Burns, assuming for the sake of argument he had the discriminatory animus that's been alleged he has, there's no way he could have passed that along to the commissioner. The commissioner had no access to him, and as a result, he made the decision with no animus. Therefore, we ask that this court affirm the summary judgment entered by the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Norberg. Mr. Lavelle?
May it please the court, with all due respect for opposing counsel, he's trying to ignore the fact that Burns was the cause of all things that happened in this case. Everything has Burns as the nexus. Burns was a supervisor. Burns harassed the most brutishly way possible these two Puerto Ricans, these two individuals. Right at the beginning, he challenged them as to why two Puerto Ricans could run an all-black program. At the same time, he brutishly harassed them and caused them to suffer for a 12-month period. That's what the hostile workforce time period is. Let's look at some of the comments made by counsel. Failed to put them on notice. They were told they couldn't talk to the commissioner. They were ordered not to talk to the commissioner. The highest person they were able to talk to was Deputy Commissioner Ormond, who was one rank below the commissioner, who also told them they could not talk to the commissioner. They talked to the head of the personnel. They talked to Chief Weidman, who was right up there next to Orman, or right below Orman, Assistant Deputy Commissioner.
Why didn't they file under the established plan? Right.
They did not know. First of all, they were high rankers. Well, they're high rankers. Let's assume they did know. I don't know whether they knew or not. The record isn't clear on that. The record doesn't say one way or the other. But the record does say that they felt, because of their rank and because of the orders, that they couldn't file any reports, that they couldn't do anything like that. So even if they were aware of the fact that a complaint could have been filed, they were ordered not to do so. That is very solid in the record. It's unrebutted.
Excuse me, did you say because of their high rank they felt they couldn't do it?
They felt they had an exempt position. They felt that because of their position, that they, first of all, they felt that they had to follow the chain of command. They had to follow the orders. Secondly, for whatever caused them to believe this, it's not clear in the record, but they felt that somehow or other they were in a status where they couldn't, in effect, lower themselves by making that kind of a report. They were trying to work it out.
Wouldn't you think if somebody was empowered, would feel empowered if they were in a higher rank rather than someone who was at an entry level in an organization?
Well, that might be true, but I don't know. That would be a fact question that a jury should decide, I would think. And it shouldn't be decided on the basis of taking their right to a jury away. It's just the fact of the matter is that they were on notice because the supervisor, Burns, was their direct supervisor. He created adverse employment conditions for them and gave them an adverse employment action. I guess I might have.
You can make the concluding remark. I don't want to cut you off.
Thank you. Well, I think this whole case has to be viewed from Burns. Burns caused the action by the commissioner by putting them in a position where they couldn't do their jobs, which consequently resulted in the bad reports, and that's what the commissioner acted on. That's a cat's paw theory here. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you, sir. All right. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.